The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to part two of my interview with one of the owners and VP of sales of Henry Appellum. Yes, Daniel Speck. I'm Matthew Cause. Of course, this is the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'll get to the second part in just a moment where we pick it up on reviews of, we're in the second Baco Noir that Daniel has poured for me, and then we get into best movie and TV scenes involving wine. Daniel's pick of The Jerk, a great Steve Martin film. He's got a really good explanation for it, and that's a lot of fun. Plus, we get into why is it difficult to sell in Ontario and what a tough vintage looks like at a winery like Henry Appellum. But I wanted to rant for a quick second, and this podcast is not really a political one. I know I talk about climate change from time to time, but that's really not political. That's, hey, how's everything doing there, Earth? And, you know, I find that stuff fascinating, especially because I didn't do very well in science, so I'm trying to make up for lost time. But there was a tweet the other day that and I wanted to talk about, because as I'm recording this, it's Boxing Day. And the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, tweeted out a couple days ago, the LCBO is bringing more convenience to Ontario consumers this holiday season. 50 locations will be open on Boxing Day, and they will be expanding their hours permanently, effective January 4th, 2019. Please enjoy responsibly. And my first thought is, for most of us, unless you live in really rural areas, how difficult is it for you to fill up your brown LCBO bag? How many times have you been, oh, I wish I could get booze, but oh, it's too early or it's too late? Like, I don't think that's something that has happened to many of us. It's never happened to me or friends I know. I think there's been once where it's Sunday. I'm like, oh, damn it, this one's closed at 5. I thought it closed at 6. But And I can't speak, obviously, to the people, maybe some people that work at the LCBO that like the extended hours. Maybe this means more jobs or overtime. So I can't speak to that slice of the population. But to the Premier and to the LCBO, if you really want to make the consumer experience better, I'm all for that at the LCBO, then my suggestion would be, why not a greater selection of spirits or beer or wine? And we're doing a lot better in terms of the craft beer. And there's certain parts of the world where the LCBO is great when it comes to wine. I've discussed it before. They do a really good job in the Veneto area. There's and a lot of Italy. I think we have we're usually pretty well represented. But I don't think I'm alone here. I don't really care. I didn't need it open on Boxing Day, and I don't need longer hours, but what I would like is more selection with wine, different stuff, funky stuff, small producers, maybe more Ontario wine, more Prince Edward County stuff. Good luck finding Long Dog at any LCBO. I'd love to see that, you know, or hey, maybe make it easier for me to ship wine. What if I've tried some wine I loved in Burgundy, but to bring it home, it's either illegal or you're going to be paying a ton in taxes to get that done. So, and I'm speaking this on more on the wine side, but again, this is a wine podcast, what do you expect? But same thing with scotch or whiskey, you know, vodka, whatever, you know, whatever your weapon of choice is. I just think that, you know, now it's open longer and it's open on Boxing Day, that doesn't move the needle. And I imagine for most of you listening, you're probably fine. You probably are able to get your drink, and you're able to, you know, because there's tons of LCBOs, you know. And you can't buy, you know, a bottle of rosé at 3 in the morning, but I think you'll survive. And most people do their planning and they're open for long hours. Anyway, just a little mini rant, just because that tweet, I was reminded of that tweet because today is Boxing Day. So again, happy holidays to everybody. I hope you, as you're listening to this, you're off today. It's Wednesday the 26th. Hey, I hope you're off for the rest of the week. Anyway, enough of me yammering. Let's get back to it. We're in the second Baco Noir, as Daniel's tried to convince me that Baco Noir is a good wine. Thank you very much for listening. And here is Mr. Speck. If you're describing this one on the palate, the second wine, the old vine.
So what happens as you go up, and this will, you'll start to see the most fine point of it as we get to the next wine. But as you move through these wines, we're into a wine that's more expensive than the last one. It's a more specific sense of place, and without, you know, trying to like losing people. In the palate, it becomes more refined. It's more. It's kind of like going from, if the first wine was ribs with barbecue sauce, this now you're getting into something that's a little more like, to make the analogy, like a Sunday roast.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And when I go back and taste, the first one, yeah, the first one now just seems so much more just a very simple fruit-driven mm-hmm. one when you compare it with the old vine. So yeah, you can... It's easy, especially when you taste a little bit of both. You can see the qualitative jump that's gone on,
for sure. And there, and it's more focused, less broad flavors, but complex, right? I mean, and that use of oak is very important, as it always is in wine. It gives it, you know, that's part of the character of the wine.
As we're pouring the third one, the only question that I sent to you ahead of time, and this is only because doing my research on you. You, in an interview, I think with Rick Van Sickle, you made a Mae West reference.
I love Mae West.
A Mae West movie reference. And I immediately picked up on it. The quote is, when I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
She's a genius.
Yeah. Not a lot of people are referencing Mae West. So then I realized, okay, your favorite wine scenes in either TV or film. Do you have... because I got one that I always like to bring up, but I haven't brought it up on the pod, but you have one that you really like. Or the other end, if you want to rip how movies handle wine, I'd love to hear that as well.
So I got your email last night, but just as I was getting on the plane, and it was, I'm glad you sent it in advance, because this was one I had to think about, because so many wine movies absolutely suck.
Yeah.
They just, and then, you know, even as, you know, as look, a professional in any industry is going to see the flaws of their industry described, but it's not even that. It's the sappy side of it that I don't like. I love the beauty of wine, but it's also, it's a real thing, and I hate it when it becomes all schmaltzy or baloney.
Yeah.
But it's funny, I was thinking about this a bit, and it's I mean, the movie I'm going to tell you about, it's one that my brother Paul took me to when I was 5 years old.
It wasn't Das Boot, was it?
Wasn't Das Boot. 2 years before Das Boot. I went to that with my parents. It came out when I was 5 years old, and I've always loved it. I just, again, watched it with my kids not long ago. It's The Jerk.
Oh, yeah. The Jerk, Steve Martin.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, wait a minute. Okay, I think I know this scene.
He's in the restaurant with, what is her name? Lazara was her Bernadette Peters.
Bernadette Peters.
Just a total
yeah.
sidebar. I don't think Bernadette Peters knows who I am from A Hole in the Wall. I just learned through one of my cousins that she's a cousin of mine.
Really?
Yeah, through my Sicilian side of the family in New York. Yeah. But I don't think she's going to be picking up the phone if I call her anytime. But anyways, so he's in the restaurant with her, and you know, the Jerk is, he's just a total neophyte, and he's kind of a Forrest Gump kind of character, but also adult. And yeah, he asks for a wine recommendation. They say the Mouton 1966 Monsieur would be lovely, and he says, "No, I won't take that. Bring us some of the newer wine. None of these old junky, dusty wines. Trying to pawn that off. Bring me the new one, the delicious one." Blah, 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 blah. That's a good movie.
Yeah, you know who ripped that off?
Who?
Dumb and Dumber. When
Christ, I forgot about that.
And Jim Carrey, when they're rich and they go to the restaurant, they're like, "Bring us your newest and freshest wine."
Yeah.
Wait a minute, they ripped that off from
that's
The Jerk.
That's great. That's funny. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a movie. I never saw Dumb and Dumber. I completely missed that until about 2 years ago.
By the way, in The Jerk, isn't there a scene after he becomes wealthy where he's got like water, he's got like the water coolers, but it's filled up with, I think it's filled up with wine instead of water. And I think playing tennis or something. And then it's the little white cup you'd use to fill up for your water. But I think it's wine. I might be wrong. Okay.
He's a classic. What's yours?
So you go The Jerk. I'm going to go something different. I'm going to go, I don't know if, do you watch Game of Thrones?
I have not seen Game of Thrones.
I never watched it until my girlfriend was working on a cruise ship. She was gone for 5 months.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, I have all this time on my hands. Let's watch that Game of Thrones everyone's talking about. By the way, this is a spoiler alert, but if anyone listening, okay, fast forward 2 minutes. Yeah. This happened two seasons ago. So one of the main characters, the evil queen, her name is Cersei, and she is evil personified, but eventually people start to love her. She blows up basically all of her enemies. It's this crazy, crazy scene, and it is violent and just wipes out hundreds and hundreds of people. And there's a POV shot of her standing, looking outside at all the destruction. And she just takes her glass of wine, takes a nice hearty sip, and just has this, not a giant smile, just a little self-satisfied smile. And I remember thinking, damn, no one is happier right now drinking wine than her. Like, she could not be happier with herself. And I remember thinking, watching that moment, I'm like, no one is enjoying their glass of wine as much as she is enjoying that glass of wine at that moment, because this is her greatest triumph. And how is she celebrating? How we all celebrate a moment of victory with a glass of wine. So that's probably my favorite. And we were debating, so again, spoiler alert, I'm sorry. But I didn't tell who died in that scene. But we were talking about the one mystery in the movie Sideways, where the Paul Giamatti character, right, Miles, when he's about to go into the restaurant early on, he's a little bit drunk, and he says, I'm not drinking bleeping Merlot. And that scene hurt Merlot's sales, which is hilarious and tragic. But then near the end of the movie, his favorite bottle, I think it was a 63 or 66, I think 63, Cheval Blanc, that's got 40% Merlot in it. So did the writers not know? Was that done on purpose? We were sort of debating it, and you brought up an interesting theory.
Well, I mean, is it the case that that's kind of the whole point of it, is that he's so poncy, he doesn't realize, you know, at the end of the day, he's a Merlot drinker. Like, yeah, like really, to say you hate a grape variety can be extreme. I mean,
yeah,
there's good examples always of something, and it may not be your taste or not, but I think they're just kind of calling them out on that a little bit. But or maybe they missed it.
So I like that, because yeah, either he was a bit of a faker, and it's funny, in some ways that movie it helped Pinot Noir, it helped put wine on the map, but it really also, you know, made the wine lover look more pretentious. Like when he's like, and there's a slight flutter. I love what someone describes. There's a slight, I forget what fruit he said, or, you know, but when someone goes, there's a slight flutter of sort of a slightly bruised yellow apple. You know, like, I love when that happens. But that movie then really put a spotlight on wine douchebaggery. Yeah, I wonder, was it a screw up by the writers, or was it done to sort of take a shot at Miles? That's interesting. I never thought about that. What are we drinking now? What's the third Baco Noir?
So this is the Speck Family Reserve. So when we're getting like really proud of ourselves, we start naming wines after ourselves. And this is a wine that, this is our oldest vineyard. So this is when we were driving out earlier. Mm-hmm. The row starts out basically straight, and as you drive along, the subsequent rows next to it get curvier and curvier and more bent, because we planted these as kids with our shovels on a hill. And if you can imagine walking from the north to the south on a hill, you know, there's a bit of a curve there. It's hard to keep straight on something like that. And so we didn't get them straight, but they got planted with the hill, which actually turns out to not have been a bad thing. And so the rows look like they were planted by children, but they're beautiful. It's a beautiful old vineyard.
I do love that. Listen, some of you, and if people come and check it out, some of your rows have been, you know, laser guided or GPS guided, and some were late teen, early 20-year-old
guided. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they're beautiful. I mean, it's a great site. It's got a lot of southern exposure, which if you're in the northern hemisphere, it's like if you're sitting in a lawn chair. If you're laying flat, you get one kind of suntan. If you're laying with your chair sitting up a little bit,
yep,
the top of your head burns, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing happens.
Like, people don't realize that. Like, If you drive through Burgundy, it's crazy. You can look at some of the famous hills at the Côte de Nuit or Côte de Beaune, and it's like, okay, you see the bottom of the hill? That wine is $85 to $105. You get to the middle, well, ooh, that one there, that's an $800 bottle. And then if you go 8 feet up higher, well, now we're back to $125. It's like, oh, there's Village, Premier, Grand, Premier, all in the span of 100 or so feet.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just in a vineyard like 2 days ago in Minervois, and La Levinière is the place. Clos d'Auray is the wine. And the vineyard's at the bottom of the hill to the top of the hill, and there is a noticeable difference in temperature when you're there, even this time of year, which is, what, November, December. It's a two-week difference in the ripening. Mm-hmm. And in our own reality, from the lake shore of Niagara to our vineyard, which is 7 kilometers south, there's, with Chardonnay, for example, you definitely see about a week to 2 weeks difference, being close to the lake versus being more inland, where it's warmer, more inland. And within sites and parcels within our vineyards, we see those differences for sure.
And that's, it's funny, and I never meant to do it when I started doing this pod, but there's a couple themes that that are now coming out, especially when I talk to winemakers. And the one that always comes out is that we don't recognize in Ontario winemaking the difference in the specific sites. You know, part of it is just Ontario wine for so long has gotten a bad name. But I think it's so important that to explain to people that mm-hmm. if the vineyard is closer to the highway versus closer to the escarpment, there is going to be you can plant the exact same grape and treat it the exact same way, and have the exact same either stainless steel, oak treatment, whatever you want, but it'll be a very different wine. I think that's an important thing for, especially for the newbie wine people, the ones just getting into wine, need to know that there is variations depending geographically, and you don't need to be 10 miles apart.
No, not at all. I mean, our own vineyard, we have two sites on our farm where we grow Pinot Noir, more than that, but two in particular that really stand out to me. One's on heavy clay, one's on heavy clay with silty loam on top of it, which may not mean much to people when I say those things,
yeah.
But one produces a more powerful wine and the other produces a more delicate wine. And we're same plants, same clones, like we know it's there, and we factor that into the winemaking. And if people want to have an experience of this actually in Niagara, just to do a shout out to one of the coolest tastings, I think it happens every year. It's a dinner. There's a whole bunch of things related to it. It's called the Pinot Affair. Mm-hmm. It's a Google. You can find it. The Pinot Affair. It happens in Niagara in the spring. I when we did it this year, I think we had 13 wines over vintages from 2013 to 2017. And about 10 different wineries. And we covered the whole peninsula. And these wines were exceptional. I mean, it was, for me, just as I was there working, sort of. I was there as a consumer just to represent. I was representing, but I was really just there to eat. It was a great day for me.
Yeah.
And going through all these wines, I was blown away at the wines from Hidden Bench, the wines from Taz and Reds, and from, God, who all was there? I feel bad. Malivore, and of course, Henry of Pelham was there. Cave Spring. And I feel bad for my friends who I haven't mentioned. But these guys, these wines were like unbelievable. And obviously all Pinot Noir, and obviously showing a different facet of it from where they were positioned and who made them. And no grape shows this more than Pinot Noir, except yeah. perhaps Riesling.
Yeah, and I think what's important to impress upon when someone's going to try Ontario wine, you know, and I'm not comparing it to Burgundy, but in Burgundy, Chasson Montrachet and Poulinet Montrachet
right.
are different. You can get a Pinot from Pommard. It'll be wildly different than Chambon Moussigny, and they are not that far apart, but it's just the variation, the vineyard variation. And the same thing exists here in Ontario. And I think sometimes it's an insult to all the winemakers and, you know, the people making the wine when we just clump it all. Oh, it's Niagara wine. No, it's not.
Oh, no.
In Niagara, there's this sub-appellation and this one. And I think it's something that winemakers, the VQA, the LCBO, the government needs to do a better job to impress upon wine, the people buying wine either at the store or ordering at restaurants, to realize that there is a difference. Because when you realize there's a difference, it creates a high level of prestige or legitimacy to the wine when you realize, yeah, we're all making our own expressions of terroir, and they're all going to be different.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the gray wine regions of the world have a very strong craft aspect to them, craft production aspect to them. And that is certainly, I mean, it's, you know, exemplified in your comments about Burgundy. And Burgundy, you know, it's very many small premium brands and they're really delving into the soil of this specific place. And that's certainly true here in Ontario. I mean, I would say in BC as well, for that matter. I don't know. I don't even know what a big winery is, frankly, because there are none. Every winery here is producing very often a lot of individual wines because it's the nature of the region.
Yeah.
But they're small production wines. I mean, they're very high quality, small craft, handcrafted wines.
You were telling me before, like you were comparing the amount of average cases produced per year by most Ontario wineries, and it's far less than Petrus. And Petrus is, you know, one of the highest end French wines, maybe the highest end Bordeaux French wine, and they make more cases per year than most of the wineries here.
Well, yeah, I mean, Petrus is one of the great wines of the world, so yeah. It becomes a reference, and it's a very small production wine. I mean, it's a very high quality small production wine, thousands of dollars a bottle, and it's one of the great wines that should be respected. I mean, it's amazing, and I would say that many of the producers in Ontario, I mean, don't make any wine in as much production as even this great, highly renowned small production wine from Bordeaux. I mean, it's not to say anything about Petrus. It's to say that...
No, it's just to recognize
to that... To say that that small... Probably even smaller production. I mean, yeah. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. And it really... you were telling me, it really hammers the point, you use the word craft, is that when you think of Ontario wine, you know, everyone loves craft beer. Well... Here it's craft wine as well, and I never looked at it through that prism.
Absolutely, and you know, a lot of the craft breweries, what do they look like? They make multiple products, multiple different beers that they make, because the nature of their business is that they're the small guys, and so they approach the market with unique seasonal beers and they have their mainstays, but are always fresh and individual batches of interesting stuff. And that's basically what happens here. I think even what we would consider a larger winery here, which by any standards anywhere isn't really that large, it's a lot of small production wines put together. We're more like craft workshops than we are like anything else.
So what's the third and final Bacco Noir? I was wondering if you could, what do you get on the palate? What do you get on the nose? And sorry, this is the reserve, as yes. You said a couple of minutes ago, yes. When you're really proud of it, you throw your name on
That's
it.
That's right.
I appreciate.
Speck Family Reserve. Yeah. So the Speck Family Reserve, this now becomes a single vineyard that we're sourcing from. It's that oldest vineyard with the crooked rows that we planted with the shovels. And again, to say it again, it's old because the vineyard is old because it's good. It's not good because it's old. And what that means here is we get beautiful ripeness with beautiful consistency. It's a more even further refined expression of this wine. So it's going to be less, you know, again, it's funny. As you go up in the tiers, the big time juiciness gives way to more structured and layered fruit flavors.
Yeah.
This is aged in small barrels, but then we put it, actually you can see it, we age it, then finish it in those large 5,000 liter foudres. So from the little 225 liter barrels, we start to marry this wine together in those three 5,000 liter foudres over there. To the foudre is like a big barrel, essentially.
Big barrel, yeah.
And it's a way to sort of integrate the different batches. I like to think of it like spaghetti sauce. Like when you make it, it's fine. But a week later, it's better.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're kind of doing by putting the little parcels together into a larger vessel. Still not a massive thing, but it makes it a better wine. And this is coming from that oldest vineyard of 34 years.
What I appreciate is, yeah, you can definitely tell the difference. I'm going, as you were talking, I've been going back and tasting from the first level to the old vine and to the final one.
Yeah, we're trying to express different things in these wines, and we're obviously, you know, they're more expensive as you go up in the tiers. But as much as anything, though, that's about occasion and context for when you're going to drink them, and
yeah,
you know, so that drives the style as much as anything.
Well, I will say this:
this has definitely been the most enjoyable Baco Noir experience of my life. And the funny thing is, what I've never done in this pod, and I don't think I'll ever do, I'm not gonna shit talk wineries I don't like. And the reason is, and it's not because I'm trying to just be nice, friendly, polite guy. It's because even what I consider the really bad wines, and man, I've tasted some Baco Noir where just horrible. But A, that's just my personal taste. And B, there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into even that bad Baco Noir. And there's other people that probably really like it, and they found context for them enjoying it. I just haven't, because again, you can't like everything. And so, yeah, I'm always hesitant. Like on this pod, I'm only going to talk about wines I recommend, unless it's Fusion or Yellowtail, and then I'm just going to just crap on that all day long. But these ones are a little bit more restrained. They don't have just what I find a negative gamey meat quality or an over-the-top, not a good smoky, but a bad smoky. Like there's certain things I look for, and green notes that I find in bad. Excuse me. I don't know if I'll edit that out. I'll probably leave it in. Of bad Baco Noir. And these certainly, they taste, they're more structured. There is more, it's just, this is a higher quality Baco than I'm used to drinking. So people out there, if you're going to try a Baco Noir, while I won't tell you which ones not to drink, just because I don't want to be a jerk, the Henry Pelham ones, these ones aren't bad. Like I've enjoyed these. Again, I probably wouldn't buy them because there's other wines of yours that I like more, but I've enjoyed these more than I thought I was coming in.
Hey, that's fine. I mean, it's, these sorts of wines, I think that Baco, I think Zinfandel, I think Malbec tend to be a little more polarizing than some of the other varietals out there. Even Shiraz can be that way because it's, you know, their broader style and some people like more than others. And we're right in that wheelhouse of what I heard described of as once, and I thought it was very appropriate, the woolly reds, Baco, Malbec, Zin, Shiraz.
Yeah.
And people are in or they're not in, but they're more in than not in. So and for us, it kind of defines a bit of who we are and what the winery is. So, hey, we're happy.
Yeah, and listen, there's a lot of bad Zin, but there's also Turley, Robert Bialy, Ridge.
Absolutely. You know, Ridge Geyserville, 86, was the wine that I think opened me up to wine.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, is that it? Do you have an origin story?
So when I came back from college, and I've been familiar with wine, of course, but when I was first out and about and doing this for full time for a living outside of the vineyard side, actually, 7 days a week, literally 7 days a week in those days, but 5 days a week. I remember visiting my mom in Toronto, who's still with us actually, and she cooked me dinner. It was a nice home cooked meal, and she had a cellar of some interesting wines. And I remember grabbing that 86 Ridge Geyserville and had it with just spaghetti and meat sauce.
Yeah,
and my mom's though, her version, and it was just blew me away. And I was like, this okay? Now I get that wine is 10 years old at the time, and I was like, okay, now I get why people really like wine.
How old were you?
I would have been 22, probably,
yeah,
okay. Something like that.
Yeah.
And it was just that, it was what I loved about it. I think, I mean, it probably could have been a number of wines, but you know, Zinfandel is an approachable grape. It's woolly enough, so I probably it resonated with me with regards to tobacco. And it was the aged character on it that I really, that intrigued me. I'd never really had aged wine in any significant way before. And that set me on a path if I really love aged wines. I mean, I just had an amazing experience with some really old wines last week that it just, brings me back to those days, So.
Yeah. By the way, this is the second part of the Dan Speck interview. We've gone about 58 minutes, so this will be broken. As you're listening, this will be into two parts because there's a couple more questions I want to get.
Sure.
And by the way, eventually, I want to talk to all three brothers. It's like The Godfather, except for part three is not that bad. Like, listen, if you get rid of...
So interesting you say that.
If you get rid of the Sofia Coppola, Andy Garcia, their sort of, love story.
Yeah.
If you eliminate that, it's actually a pretty good movie. Okay, it's not as good as part two or one, but it's still a good movie, and it gets crapped on more than it should.
Absolutely. My son and I just did a marathon with the three of them, and I'd been warning him. He's like 12, right? I was warning him, okay, this third one, I was debating whether I watch it because I didn't want to ruin the first two.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it since it first came out, and I was like, God, that was terrible. But you know what? You're right, exactly right. You take out that that part of it. The movie's actually pretty good.
Yeah, it's really not a bad movie. So yeah,
and yeah, she's not a bad director, you know.
No, she's come around, and also, you know, a lot younger then, and
it's a different time.
Yeah, exactly. But a couple more questions while I got you here. The issue of selling Ontario wine to Ontario, because you're the VP of sales.
Sure.
I'd love your thoughts on this. And my own theories on why people in Ontario, you know, are just, it's taking longer to get them to fully warm to it. One, I use a sports analogy. Torontonians don't like the CFL. They love the NFL. Why? Because the NFL, it is a higher quality of football because the best players are there because they get paid more money. Even though the CFL is wildly entertaining. I write for the CFL.ca. I like all types of football. So I think there's Ontario, well, California or Italy or France, those are the only ones who are going to drink. I think also in the 80s and in the 90s, a lot of vineyards, they weren't really on their game because they were still new at it and vines were young. And I think a lot of winemakers, they would make 17 different types of varieties, including Cabernet Sauvignon. And I'm like, no. Just make the ones that work here. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that just takes time for people to realize, okay, what we should be making. And I think those things sort of combine where it put Ontario wine behind in terms of trying to sell it to Ontarians. I mean, so that's sort of my garden variety theory. I'm curious.
I think those things are all correct. There's a lot, you know, as you said, it's multifaceted. I think that we're also, you know, a small wine region, right? We're a small wine region in a big market. And it's a very international wine market too. So, you know, the industry is fairly new, ultimately. It's been around for a little while now, but still fairly new. And as it's been developing its skill and its specialties, we're still diluted by, you know, a lot of international wines, because you know, they have established themselves here very strongly, and good for them for pounding away at this market. And we're the newer guys. We're still the upstarts. So it's on us to try and find our customer and tell the story. Part of it, though, is also that it's a lot of craft winemaking. And so you know, even a lot of the really premium wines that people drink here from other places, they are very much wooed by what are actually pretty big international brands, or in the North American context anyways, and probably don't realize that they're, you know, they're Niagara wine producers, you know, a 500, 1,000 case premium wine for $22, $23 versus a pretty mass wine from another place for the same price.
Yeah.
Not taking a hit at that wine that's sort of the mass end of things, but the smaller craft brand from that same foreign place doesn't really make it to this market in the same way because they're not export ready, right? So you're talking, you know, it's a David and Goliath there. Little producers here up against some pretty big international guys. And the big international guys are strong, you know, and they grab the market.
Yeah, and it can be tough. Like I look at, say, Rocca della Macy, and, you know, the LCBO buys lots of their wines. And that's a DOCG, Chianti Classico. So it checks, and it's a good wine.
It
checks all the boxes of what a wine buyer wants. Oh, Chianti Classico. Oh, Italian. Oh, it's $19.95, or sometimes they knock $2 off it, and suddenly you're getting it for like $18. And then it's like, well, why would I buy this, you know, Ontario wine that's $24 when I can spend $18 on Chianti Classico? And if you're new to wine, when you think of wine, Chianti Classico is a term that's pretty recognizable.
Yeah, it's been, you know, many, many years of building the brand. They have more horsepower because of economies of scale and efficiency, whether it's this brand or others that are more scaled up. And but, you know, the reason to buy the local wine is not, though, because we should be supporting the hometown just because it's the hometown. I mean, at the end of the day, the wines have to be good, and they are good, and they offer a lot of value for money. I would say, actually, in many cases, you're going to pay more for the international wines than for the domestics, because it's a leaner game. But it's also a very successful. I don't want this to come off as a sad story, because it's not. The domestic industry is strong. These are well-made artisanal wines. People know who they are and what they have to be from the production side, and it's a lot of passion, a lot of interesting things happening, and some, you know, I think it's as much about exploration and we just love people to, you know, get out and for every two of the ones one foreign wine you buy, throw a domestic one in there just to see what's out there, because I think you're going to be surprised, you know.
Last question for you. Toughest vintage, and you don't, you know, or just What does do you have one in mind? Is there one year recently that comes to mind? And if not, it's okay, because really the question is, what does that look like and feel like for you guys, just one of those incredibly tough vintages?
So it's really interesting. I think that we often measure ourselves on how the cabs come in.
Yeah.
But the bulk of what we make, and that's the latest thing in the season to come in. But there's a lot of time between September and October, November, when the Bordeaux overheads come in, Cabernet Sauvignon, for example. And so Pinot, Chard, Riesling, Bacco is the first thing we pick. The grapes for sparkling wine, the grapes for rosé, Pinot Grigio, all that stuff comes in earlier. So the wines that we're most consistent with are our best wines, and they're the ones that we're most... We rarely have the question of what is a greater or lesser vintage. So our challenge, our biggest challenge is always with the Bordeaux Reds. Mm-hmm. And then from there, when we focus on Merlot and Cabernet Franc, that's when we have our greatest success. And those wines are actually very good here with consistency, I would say. So what is a great vintage? I don't have to make it complicated, but every grape comes in at a different time. And so you can have a great vintage for Chardonnay and a tougher vintage for, I don't know, Cab Sauv and perhaps vice versa. For me, A tough vintage is just one where
at the wrong time. Like,
yeah. Oh God, hell.
What 2015 did for, you know, especially like Prince Edward County got hit hard.
They got hit hard. It's one where for me, the vintage is made or broken in late August, early September, when the grapes have just turned color.
Yeah.
And the ripening happens. What we don't really like to see too much rain. So that's, you know, that can, you know, this year was a bit tricky for that, but we managed to pull off some very, very good wines. We try to avoid those years where it's really rainy at harvest, though. That's always the first indicator of difficulty, because a season can start early or late. Things change faster.
Daniel, thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Give a website or where are you guys? For people that are coming, it's a pretty easy trip. But where do people, if people want to come, where do they come visit you?
So we're technically in St. Catharines. We're in the countryside, though. Henryofpelham.com. You can find out about visiting, and it's a beautiful spot to visit. There's a cafe that's open in the high season, the spring, summer, fall. And, check out our wine club at henryofpelham.com. And it's the right kind of wine club for me. It's not one where we're trying to actually jam wine down people's throats. It's more about events, things that happen in your area, and building a relationship. Because, you know, we like to say, you know, come as a customer, leave as family, that kind of thing. Stay in touch with us.
Yeah, it's a fantastic line of products, from the cuvée, you know, from your sparkling, all the way to just a lot of the reds, and not bad Bacco Noir.
Hey, right on. That's an endorsement.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher, wherever good podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.